Welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona, your 24-hour reading station. You are listening to the Personal Finance Show with your volunteer broadcaster, Marianne Doty. On this show, I will read from the December issue of Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine. Some of the articles to be covered are Long-Term Care Claims, Avoid the Obstacles, Living in Retirement by Janet Bodner, and 5 Ways to Max Out Your Credit Card Rewards. So, without further ado, let's go to Long-Term Care Claims, Avoid the Obstacles. Filing a claim can be an ordeal, but these preventive measures will streamline the process. By Kimberly Langford. Buying long-term care insurance is usually a smart way to protect your finances and your family from the potentially massive cost of care. But after paying premiums for years, you don't want the insurance company to hassle you or your children when you submit a claim. Even if the insurance company ultimately pays out, the claims process can be slow and complicated. It's easy to make mistakes that could delay or jeopardize the payout. And the person who bought the policy ordinarily isn't the one who submits the claim. One frequent sticking point is the waiting period. Some policies have a 0-day waiting period for home care and a longer waiting period for nursing homes and assisted living. The fine print can even trip up the experts. Jennifer Burnham Grubbs is the co-founder of Quantum Insurance Services in Los Angeles. Her father-in-law, Carol Lamb, who recently died at age 84, bought a policy when he was in his early 50s. After a heart attack, he needed help with several activities of daily living. His wife, Donna, age 72, had been providing the care, but it was getting increasingly difficult, and they realized that his long-term care policy could pay for professional caregivers. The policy had a 60-day waiting period. Jennifer thought that meant it would start to pay out 60 days after the insurer said he qualified for care, even if Donna was the one to care for him. But the policy only counted the weeks when he received at least 2 hours of care from a caregiver who was certified by the state. That was eye-opening, says Burnham Grubbs. Now that we've been close to it, we see the nuances firsthand. In many cases, 20 years or more have passed between buying the policy and using the benefits. And in that time, the types of care and rules for new policies may have changed. Bonnie Burns of California Health Advocates worked with a woman who was considering an assisted living facility with a memory care unit for her mother, who had dementia. But because such facilities didn't exist when she bought the policy 20 years ago, the claim was initially denied. Burns helped her appeal to the insurer, showing that the memory care unit met the policy's licensing and care requirements, and the insurer ended up paying the claim. The following steps can help your long-term care claim go smoothly for yourself or your relative, and help you fight back if you're having trouble getting your claim paid. Review the policy with your adult children. It's important to let your adult children or another person you trust know about your long-term care insurance long before you need to use it, when you're usually not in a position to handle the claim yourself. Give your adult children a copy of the policy and let them know how to start the claim. Make sure they have the contact information for the insurance company's claim department and the agent who sold you the policy. Review the requirements for receiving payouts with them so that they can keep an eye out if you start to need help with activities of daily living or become cognitively impaired. Find out what documentation the insurer requires for them to handle the claim on your behalf, such as a power of attorney and HIPAA authorization. Also, find out about special rights your representative may have in your state. In Pennsylvania, for example, an insurer is required to send notices not only to the insured, but also to the authorized representative, says Carolyn Morris, director of the Consumer Services Bureau for the Pennsylvania Insurance Department. That person should be actively involved in what is going on. You should review the policy and should make sure there is an understanding of its terms and conditions. If you don't have children or relatives nearby, you may want to choose a geriatric care manager or other professional who can help when needed. Next, contact the insurer before you choose a caregiver or facility. Some of the biggest problems happen when people pick a facility or home care worker before they find out the policy's requirements. Some older policies cover nursing home care, but not assisted living or home care. Some that cover home care will only pay a licensed caregiver who works with an agency. After her 92-year-old mom had trouble walking and caring for herself, Ellen Penske, not her real name, was told by the insurer that benefits would start after a 90-day waiting period, as long as her mother received care at least once a week during that time. Penske, who lives in Northern California, some 400 miles from her mother, documented the care her mother received from a variety of caregivers during those 3 months. But she didn't know that the caregivers had to be licensed until the insurer told her that the care didn't count toward the waiting period. None of those first 3 months counted, she says. It was very frustrating. It's never too early to contact the insurance company and ask questions. Even if you aren't sure you have a claim yet, it's best to put the insurance company on notice and tell them what's going on, says Mike Ashley of Senior Benefits Consultants in Prairie Village, Kansas. The insurer can explain the requirements and may even help you find caregivers or facilities in your area that qualify. Next, understand how to qualify for benefits. Most long-term care policies sold since 1997 will pay out if you need substantial assistance with 2 out of 6 activities of daily living, such as bathing, dressing, toileting, transferring, eating, and continence, or if you have severe cognitive impairment and need substantial supervision. But older policies may have other criteria, such as requiring a 3-day hospital stay first. The documentation can be detailed and complicated and can vary by company and policy. Genworth, for example, has an online claims portal where you can submit the information and then talk with an intake specialist who will start the claim and then send out a nurse for an exam. Some other insurers require a lot of faxing. Typically, we will arrange for a nurse to go to the insured to assess the insured's functional abilities, cognitive status, personal needs, and environment to assist us in determining benefit eligibility, says Leonard Savini, Vice President of Long-Term Care Claims at Genworth. Based on this assessment, we may request medical information from doctors. Make sure the doctor submits required information. Go about getting the documentation and making sure the providers provide it, says Leslie Pierce, Health Division Chief in the Pennsylvania Insurance Department's Bureau of Consumer Services. Delays in the claims process are sometimes on the side of the provider. The diagnosis is important, but that's not really what insurers are looking for, says Ashley. They're looking for whether you need substantial assistance with the activities of daily living or substantial supervision with cognitive impairment. He recommends that family members document the help their parents need or evidence of cognitive impairment. Your insurance broker may be able to help, as Sheila Molina and her mother Gloria Schwartz discovered. Schwartz, 88, started having trouble with mobility after heart surgery and other health issues, and Molina asked her to consider moving from her home in Wisconsin to an assisted living facility near her in Illinois. They dug up the long-term care policy Gloria bought 20 years ago from CNA to find out more about the requirements to receive benefits. At first, we couldn't find the policy, and the terms were difficult to understand, says Molina. Molina contacted MAGA Limited, the insurance brokerage in Bannockburn, Illinois, where her mother had originally bought the policy. Jolene Winter at MAGA became their advocate, explaining the policy's details and helping them navigate the claims process. Jolene said to come into her office and we will make sure every page is filled out correctly, says Molina. Every mistake or omission could delay the claim for months. Next, ask how the waiting period works. Long-term care policies have a waiting period, generally 30, 60, or 90 days, when you have to pay for care yourself before the policy will pay out. But the definition of this elimination period can vary a lot by policy. Some policies have a zero-day waiting period for home care and a longer waiting period for nursing homes and assisted living. And they may have different requirements for what counts. For example, policies with a calendar day elimination period start the clock ticking as soon as you meet the conditions for benefits. But some policies only count service days, the days you receive care or require a certain amount of care each week to count. Make sure you have money available to pay for care during the elimination period and possibly for a few months afterward while the claim is being approved. Find out about the fastest way the insurer can send the money. Next, find out what paperwork is required. Most policies require a lot of ongoing paperwork for the claim to continue to be paid, and the specifics vary by policy. Many policies require that evidence of incurred expenses be submitted before reimbursement will be made, says Savini. He advises policyholders to work with the caregiver or facility to make sure that any invoices submitted include all the information needed, such as the type of care provided and what activities of daily living were involved. And finally, get help if you have delays. If there's a challenge with a claim, my advice is to let your agent be your advocate, says David Eisenberg, an insurance broker in L.A. The agent, if you have one, will understand how to navigate the insurance company's claims process and can help you get a claim approved more quickly. Or you may be able to pay another agency to help with your claim. For example, people who bought their policies elsewhere can pay MAGA $1,500 or more to become their agent of record and handle their claim. Going up the ladder at the insurance company can help too. Simone Gell's father was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease when he was 71, and he eventually moved to an assisted living facility. Gell hired extra caregivers to supplement the nursing staff and help him 24 hours a day until he passed away at age 80. After a delay in receiving payments from his insurer, John Hancock, Gell called the CEO's office and was put in touch with the senior operations manager, who discovered that the checks had been delayed because the facility wasn't sending in the claim information promptly. Whenever they had delays after that, the operations manager would contact the facility to get the right information and get the claim processed quickly. Your state insurance department can also help speed up the process and get answers from the insurer. In Pennsylvania, insurers must notify you of your claim status within 30 days of filing and then update you every 45 days. Delays are the most common complaint the department receives after long-term care claims. Find your insurance department at www.naic.org/map. And that's www.naic.org/map. And let me read you a couple of other tips. This is a KIP tip, how to fight back. If the insurer denies the claim, first find out why. It could be that a provider didn't send in the proper paperwork, or you may not have met the policy's requirements. Find out about your appeal rights in your state, which usually must be spelled out in the denial letter. In Pennsylvania, for example, you have the right to request an internal appeal after a denied claim, and then an external independent review. Document the names and titles of everyone involved in the discussion when there is a claim denial, which assists us if they submit a complaint, says Carolyn Morris of the Pennsylvania Insurance Department. Your state health insurance assistance program may also be helpful. Some state programs only focus on Medicare, but some help with long-term care too. So your state health insurance assistance program can be found at www.hipptacenter.org. So that's www.hipptacenter.org. And here is what to look for: policies that avoid problems. Some key provisions in your policy could help you avoid or minimize claims problems, such as broad coverage for nursing homes, assisted living, and home care. Some policies only cover licensed home care providers who work with an agency, but others let you hire anyone who isn't related to you, and those providers may charge a lot less. A few policies pay out as long as you meet the requirements for benefits, no matter who is providing the care. Next, a calendar day elimination period. A policy with this elimination period starts the clock as soon as you qualify for care and can start paying out much faster than a policy with a service day elimination period, which only counts the days you receive care. That's especially important if you start out needing home care just a few days a week. Some policies have a 0-day waiting period for home care and a longer waiting period for nursing homes or assisted living, which can make home care claims much less complicated. Less documentation. Find out about the paperwork needed to file and continue a claim. Some insurers require caregivers to send care notes every few weeks in order to continue paying the claim and reimburse you for the costs. Others just pay out if you meet the benefit triggers, and then you decide how to spend the money. These indemnity policies are less common but don't require ongoing documentation. And finally, a shorter waiting period. You may save money in premiums by having a longer waiting period, but you'll have to pay a lot of money out of pocket first. A 60-day or 90-day waiting period is often a good balance. And that article was Long-Term Care Claims, Avoid the Obstacles by Kimberly Lankford. Next, we have Living in Retirement by Janet Bodner, Hitting My Stride in Retirement. Not long ago, I passed the 2-year mark of my retirement as editor of Kiplinger's. That apparently is something of a milestone. A study by AgeWave and Bank of America Merrill Lynch found that it can take 2 to 3 years to hit your stride in retirement. So, how am I doing? I'd say I'm pretty much on track. People often ask me if I miss being editor. My honest answer, absolutely not. I thought I had a successful run, and I was happy to move on. But I've discovered that I apparently belong to a relatively small group of retirees, 15%, that AgeWave identifies as driven achievers, who continue working in some capacity because it gives them a sense of accomplishment. Writing this column, along with Money Smart Women, a topic I have covered since writing a book on the subject in 2003, gives me that sense, and it lets me stay in touch with dozens of readers who generously share their own experiences. Driven achiever that I am, I also find myself making to-do lists, and I need to check off a few items, even small things such as sending emails or running errands each day. The part-time work and the lists add structure to my week, but I'm grateful that I have plenty of unstructured time to do a lot of satisfying things I never would have been able to fit into my schedule if I were on the job full time. For one thing, my husband and I have stepped up our exercise program. We take cycling and yoga classes together, and I take a couple of other classes on my own, all regular activities that help anchor our days and keep us healthy. Lord knows we certainly need to stay physically fit and mentally sharp to keep up with our grandchildren. We have 4 of them, ages 4 and younger. And one day a week, we babysit for the 2 who are local. That leaves time to visit the other 2 who live in Michigan every month or so. We try not to let too much time go by between visits because the children grow so fast. In fact, a lot of our increased travel time revolves around family, vacations with the kids and grandkids, and visits to our out-of-town siblings. But we've also visited 9 national parks since we retired. And next year, we're heading to Acadia in Maine with my husband's sister and her husband. Once I took off a couple of things on my to-do list each day, I give myself permission to spend time with a good book. With more opportunity for reading, I've focused on U.S. history an interest I share with my youngest child, Peter. At Peter's suggestion, I'm reading the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin, and I had time to read a recently published U.S. history textbook, Land of Hope, by Wilford Maclay, from cover to cover. Big surprises. Before I left my job, I made a list of things I do in retirement, plus a schedule of what my week might look like. Write, spend time with my grandchildren, exercise more, travel, volunteer, clean out the closets, remodel the bathrooms. And 2+ years in, I can check most of those boxes. As for volunteering, I'm involved with my church and I'm on the board of trustees at my undergraduate university. But I haven't made much headway with the closets, and the bathrooms are still a gleam in my eye. In fact, one of my biggest surprises is that my week looks so little like I pictured it. Despite being retired, I sometimes feel pressed for time, and I still look forward to weekends. What isn't so surprising is that one of my greatest pleasures is the flexibility I have in deciding how to spend my days, even when it comes to simple things. There's nothing like the freedom to run errands at noon on a Tuesday, with little traffic, lots of parking, and 60s music playing on the car radio. What has surprised you most about retirement, and what are your greatest pleasures or disappointments? I'll be happy to write about as many as I can. Janet Bodner is editor-at-large of Kiplinger's Personal Finance. Contact her at Janet_Bodner, that's spelled B-O-D-N-A-R, at kiplinger.com. And her question is, what has surprised you most about retirement, and what are your greatest pleasures or disappointments? And again, that's, you can reach her at Janet, J-A-N-E-T, _ B-O-D-N-A-R, Bodner, at Kiplinger, K-I-P-L-I-N-G-E-R, .com. And that was Hitting My Stride in Retirement. We are coming up on the midway point, and I just want to remind you that you're listening to Sun Sounds Radio, your 24-hour reading station. It is a not-for-profit, and we rely solely on donations. And this is Mary Ann Doty. I am subbing today. I typically read the Christian Science Monitor on Fridays. And I would like to wish you and your family a happy holiday and a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And now we will resume with our program on personal finance. Our next story is 5 ways to max out your credit card rewards. Play your cards right, and a first-class flight, luxe hotel suite, or a pile of cash can be yours, by Miriam Cross. If you're using a single rewards card that pays only 1 point or cent per dollar spent on your purchases, it may be time to rethink your strategy. With 3 or 4 carefully chosen cards in your wallet, you can bank enough points and miles to kick back in first class or lounge in a plush hotel suite. If travel is not your thing, or you don't want to spend time studying the ins and outs of award cards, you can still earn hundreds of dollars in cash back each year by rotating your spending among credit cards that match your spending patterns. Melissa Frank, Director of Recruitment for an education technology nonprofit, holds 9 cards. The Long Island, New York resident delegates different purchases to different cards. For example, all travel goes on her Chase Sapphire Reserve Visa, which has a $450 annual fee. Her points have taken her to South Africa in business class twice, helped treat her dad to a rainforest adventure in Peru, and cut the cost of numerous jaunts around the U.S. I can't think of one instance in recent times that I have paid full price out of pocket for a flight, she says. Whether you want to dabble in credit card rewards or dive in deep, these five strategies will help you milk more value from your points and miles. You can combine tactics to earn even greater rewards. Unless noted otherwise, the cards we recommend do not carry annual fees. For additional picks in a variety of categories, go to kiplinger.com/links/cards19. That's Kiplinger, KIPLINGER.com/LINKS/CARDS19. Don't worry, that strategies to max out rewards will lower your credit score. That won't happen as long as you avoid a few common traps. In fact, your credit score may go up. So, I'll explain to you how that works after I read the article. Number one, concentrate on cash back. This is best if you want an easy and instant return, value total flexibility with your rewards, or travel infrequently. Cash back may not have the panache of high-end travel rewards, but it's simple, versatile, and doesn't lose value over time the way that loyalty points do. Among credit card users who say rewards are the feature they look for most in a credit card, 67% favor cash back over points or other reward types, according to a report from creditcards.com. Miguel Soro, a lawyer in Miami, and his wife Lily divide their spending among three cards: Amazon Prime Rewards Visa Signature for 2% back on gas, and 5% back on Amazon.com purchases. Citi Prestige MasterCard, which costs $495 annually for 5 points per dollar spent on dining, and Chase Freedom Unlimited Visa for 1.5% cash back on everything else. But he and Lily are rethinking the strategy because no-fee cashback cards with generous rewards make more sense for them as new parents. When you first read about travel hacking, you're excited by the promise of amazing trips around the world in first class. But it takes a lot of time and energy to research, he says. Now that we are traveling less and buying lots of baby stuff, cashback is more attractive. The easiest method to rev up your cash reward rate is to rely on a single card that earns more than 1% per dollar spent. Citi Double Cash MasterCard pays a flat 2% on all purchases, as does the Fidelity Rewards Visa Signature. But you must deposit your rewards from the card into a Fidelity account. Other cards, such as the Capital One Quicksilver Visa, returns 1.5% on everything. Next, layer on one or two more cards with higher payback in categories in which you spend the most, such as dining, groceries, or gas. Dining is a hot category right now, with several cards, including the Uber Visa and Capital One Saver Rewards MasterCard, which has a $95 annual fee waived the first year, earning 4% or more at restaurants. Sticking with cashback cards that offer fixed bonus categories is easiest. If you choose cards such as the Chase Freedom Visa or Discover It, which hike earnings on new categories to 5% each quarter, you'll need to activate the categories each quarter to earn the higher rate. Recent 5% categories on those cards included home improvement stores, grocery stores, gas stations, and ride sharing. Fourth quarter categories usually focus on shopping. A couple of other cards, including the U.S. Bank Cash Plus Visa Signature, let you choose the categories that earn additional cash back, including such options as TV, internet, and streaming services, home utilities, and cell phone bills. Stay away from retail cards unless you're loyal to that store and shop there frequently, says Ted Rossman, industry analyst at creditcards.com. The sign-up bonuses are lacking compared with general-purpose cards, and even the ongoing rewards are not as attractive, he says. Some cashback cards have a catch. They cap your bonus earnings each year or quarter and drop the rate to 1% once you hit your limit. You may not worry about blowing through a $1,500 quarterly cap on, say, gas and drug stores, but a family could easily surpass the $6,000 annual limit for 6% cashback on groceries with the American Express Blue Cash Preferred, which is $95 a year. Track your spending so you can revert to a card that earns more than 1% back until the clock resets. At the same time, familiarize yourself with how your credit card issuer defines its categories. For example, it's common for credit cards to exclude gas or groceries from the top earning gas or grocery category when you buy those items at superstores such as Walmart and Target, or wholesale clubs such as Costco Wholesale and Sam's Club. Number two, Target sign-up bonuses. Best if you want to earn a hefty stash of points in a hurry or have a specific travel goal in mind. The Chase Sapphire Reserve made a splash in 2016 with its 100,000-point sign-up bonus. Mega bonuses are harder to come by these days as insurers crack down on churners who drop a card after earning the bonus. Instead, issuers are focusing on ongoing rewards, such as high returns for everyday spending, says Rossman. Still, the average sign-up bonus currently sits at an all-time high of 20,153 points or miles, according to WalletHub. New cardholders can generally expect to earn up to 50,000 or 60,000 points on travel cards with annual fees after spending several thousand dollars in the first 3 or 4 months. Sign-up bonuses or no-fee travel cards are lower, and cash-back cards typically offer $150 or $200 after spending $1,000 or less in the first few months. Discover It and Discover It Miles double all of the rewards you earn after your first year as a cardholder. Sign-up bonuses are a useful way to bulk up your stash of points in a hurry, but new cardholders can fall into traps. For one, the size of a welcome bonus can be misleading. The headline number isn't as important as what those points are worth, says Julian Mark Keel, senior analyst at thepointsguide.com. For example, he says, a 100,000-point bonus on a Hilton Honors card is not worth nearly as much as the 60,000-point bonus you get with the Chase Sapphire Preferred Visa, which is $95 a year. ThePointsGuide.com lists valuations of credit card points Ann Miles at www.thepointsguy.com/guide/monthly-valuations. Issuers are also placing more restrictions on when you can and can't get a bonus. American Express, which limits cardholders to one bonus per card per lifetime, will tell you before you complete your application whether you are eligible for the bonus. With other issuers, you may need to read the offer terms because, says Keel, some banks will give you a card even if you're not eligible for the bonus, and you won't realize it until after you've used the card. You can't open a new Chase Sapphire card if you currently hold another Sapphire card, or if you've received a bonus from a Sapphire card in the past 48 months. You also won't get a bonus on a new Citi card that accrues thank you points if you have received a bonus or closed an account with another thank you point earning card in the past 24 months. Another catch. With most cards, the clock to start your minimum spending to earn the bonus begins as soon as your card is approved, not the day you receive your card or first use it. As long as your credit score is high, it's fine to apply for an annual fee card periodically to snag an enticing welcome bonus, especially if you have a large expense on the horizon that makes it easy to hit the minimum spending requirement. You can also try bill shifting to prepay essentials and meet your minimum spending requirements within the deadline. Welcome bonuses can fluctuate, so if you don't need the points anytime soon, do some internet research to see if the bonus on the card you are eyeing changes frequently. If you decide the card benefits don't justify the annual fee, after you pocket the bonus, consider downgrading the card to a no-fee version instead of canceling it outright. If you request a product change to a no-fee card that normally carries a sign-up bonus, you generally won't get that bonus. 3. Earn transferable points. Best if you like flexibility when you travel or want to trim the costs of flights or hotels. Savvy travel hackers squeeze the most value out of credit cards that earn transferable points, which you are able to shift from your credit card to a number of airline and sometimes hotel partners. Most of these rewards programs also allow you to reserve flights, hotels, rental cars, and more through an online portal at a rate of 1% per point or better. 1 cent per point or better. You can rack up transferable points through certain credit cards tied to American Express membership rewards, Capital One, Chase Ultimate Rewards, Citi Thank You Rewards, and Marriott Bonvoy. If you're a moderate spender, it's best to concentrate your points in one program rather than spreading them around. The Chase Sapphire Preferred and Chase Sapphire Reserve are good starter cards because you will earn ultimate rewards points that you can transfer directly to JetBlue, Southwest, or United. The American Express Everyday, along with higher-end cards, such as the American Express Platinum, which is $550 a year, earn membership rewards points that can go straight to Delta or JetBlue. If you dive into the nitty-gritty of award charts, you could find even better opportunities to book tickets, even on domestic carriers, through international airline partners. 4, keep it in the family. Best if you are loyal to one bank or brand, or if you're an avid traveler who wants to earn more transferable points. Some issuers spice up their offerings for customers who have a bank account and credit card from the same company. For example, members of Bank of America's Preferred Rewards Program can earn a bonus of 25%, 50%, or 75% on rewards with eligible Bank of America credit cards. To get those bonuses, you must have a combined balance in eligible Bank of America banking and Merrill investment accounts, averaging at least $20,000 over three-month periods, with higher balances earning the bigger bonus rates. Sticking with one family of credit cards can also help you wring greater value from cashback cards. For example, if you hold the Chase Sapphire Preferred or Chase Sapphire Reserve card, you can lump any points you earn from the Chase Freedom and Chase Freedom Unlimited cards into that account. Number five, pay through a portal. Best if you like to shop online and are willing to jump through extra hoops. Making purchases through online shopping portals that link to your retailer rather than directly on the retailer's website can nab you an extra helping of cash points or miles. Airlines, credit card issuers, and other companies host online shopping portals, but the easiest way to compare rates is to search for a merchant on an aggregator site such as www.cashbackholic.com. That's www.cashbackholic.com. Cashbackholic, or www.cashbackmonitor.com, or www.evreward.com. Then follow the link directly to the portal of your choice. Don't navigate to a different page mid-purchase or disable cookies in your internet browser, or you may lose your rewards. Check your portal's terms and conditions before layering on coupon codes that you find outside of the portal's website. Using one may override your earnings. You can rake in additional points on top of your portal purchase by choosing the right credit card. For example, most U.S. airlines have a dining rewards program with which you earn bonus miles when dining at a participating restaurant. And as I mentioned earlier, your credit score won't take a hit. Holding multiple credit cards won't hurt your credit score. In fact, it may boost your score. Although your score will fall a few points every time you apply for a new card and the lender performs a hard inquiry, inquiries are a small component of your overall score. Your credit utilization ratio, the amount you owe on your credit cards as a proportion of your card's limits, is a bigger piece of your credit score, and it should improve as you add new cards to your collection and increase your available credit. To lessen the impact of new inquiries on your credit score and more easily meet spending requirements for bonuses, space out your applications to every 6 months or more. Waiting 6 months to open a new card can also help you circumvent Chase's 524 rule, which prevents you from opening a Chase card if you have opened five or more credit cards from all issuers within the past 24 months. Many issuers also restrict how many of their cards you can open in a 1, 2, or 3 month period. If you carry a balance, move it to a card with a low or 0% rate. Rewards cards tend to carry higher interest rates than other credit cards. And that article was Five Ways to Max Out Your Credit Card Rewards by Miriam Cross. And the last article I will read is also from Kiplinger's. It was overlooked in the September issue. It's called Safe Cars for Less Than $30,000. We looked at the test results of late model used cars to find the safest vehicles at the best price by David Mulbaum. You want to put yourself and your loved ones in the safest vehicle possible, right? Here's the hitch. The absolute safest vehicle is almost always a brand new model. That means used car shoppers will likely have to make a few compromises. Each year, automakers introduce more effective active safety systems, such as automatic braking, to match the evolving testing standards of the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety. Likewise, newer models often have structural improvements that help them perform better in the ILHS tests meant to closely simulate real-world collisions, such as hitting a utility pole. And the ILHS now puts added emphasis on headlight performance. To help cars earn a good headlight rating, manufacturers are using LEDs, which are proving more effective than traditional halogen bulbs, as well as curve adaptive systems that steer the light to match the direction you move the wheel. So newer and thus more expensive generally means safer. But what if you need wheels, care deeply about safety, but don't want to buy new? We worked with annual rankings from the Institute for Highway Safety and price data from cargurus.com to identify the safest vehicles you can buy for less than $30,000. However, our quest for safety first, it was not safety only. So we sought out cars that also enjoy good reputations for reliability and are popular choices in their segments. When we could, we also included some models that have excellent safety ratings that you can get into for less than $20,000. There are sometimes older versions of our under $30,000 picks. Safe small SUVs. The Mazda CX-5, model years 2018 and 19, built after November 2017, price $26,700. Small SUVs are the market's hottest niche as Americans abandon sedans for a few inches of additional ride height and the convenience of a hatchback. That popularity means less depreciation in the used vehicle market, but you can still save thousands compared with buying a new model by looking at a vehicle that's a couple of years old. With a used Mazda CX-5, you're not giving up anything on safety. The 2018 model tested as well as one you'd buy new. You could even go back to 2017. The first year of the current model's redesign, and get equal crashworthiness, how well the car's structure, airbags, and seatbelts work together to protect the occupants in a collision. But the 2017's headlights are only rated acceptable, even though they share the same technology, LED projectors and the ability to shine around curves, of the later models. Mazda seems to have made some tweaks to get more light down the road. The next is the Subaru Forester, model 2019, price $30,700. Next is the Honda CR-V, model year 2017-18, price $29,700. The huge selling Honda CR-V, a pioneer in the small SUV category, now in its fifth generation, matches the Mazda, Subaru, and Hyundai for crashworthiness and collision avoidance. Only its headlights don't quite measure up, scoring acceptable, and that's for the priciest touring trim level. In a testament to Honda's quality that these vehicles use prices are on the higher side. A 2018 model just barely squeezes under our cap. It's also the same safety-wise as the slightly cheaper 2017 version. You can't go any older, though. 2017 was the first year of the model's redesign and the first year it was tested for passenger small overlap crash safety. In the interest of time, I'm just going to name the rest of them. The Hyundai Tucson, model years 2016 to 18. The price is $22,200. And safe large SUVs are the Mazda CX-9, model years 2017 and 18, price $29,400. The safe sedans are the Toyota Camry, model year 2018-19, with the price of $26,300. The Subaru Legacy, with a model year 2018-19, with a price of $23,800. And the Hyundai Sonata, model years 2018-19, with a price of $23,800. And we are at the end of our broadcast of Personal Finance. And you've been listening to Personal Finance with me, Marianne Doty, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. We hope you have enjoyed the program and that you will join us again next week. And if you missed a program on Sun Sounds, you can listen to it whenever you want by getting it on demand. Go to sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio. Thank you and goodbye.